Well, I've enjoyed my day with you all. I've enjoyed getting to know some of you and been in a couple of homes today and ate some great food. And that's always one of my favorite things to do. I want to talk tonight about just holding on to the faith, about enduring. It's always a struggle. This is the hardest kind of sermons for me whenever it's just you come in one time and you preach. Those seem to be the most difficult times to say, well, what is it that is in God's Word that can really motivate people? And you know what I've come to understand is that regardless of where you're at and regardless of where you live, we all have some very basic needs. We all need the gospel. We all need to be encouraged from time to time. And we all have those times where we just need to hold on. But we just got to hold on to the faith where we've got to press on and endure. So our text for tonight is going to come from Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And it's hard to just jump right into Hebrews chapter 12 without first discussing just a little bit of background. Hebrews was written to a group of people who were being persecuted. They had left Judaism in order to follow Christ, and as a result, they were suffering persecution. The author of Hebrews is someone we're not really sure of. There's a lot of different possibilities and different theories that are out there. Some say Luke and Paul. Those seem to be the two most common views of who the author may be. But regardless of who it is, there are some very important things within the book of Hebrews. The author writes to tell these Christians that it is not in vain that they're continuing to follow Christ. The law of Christ is superior than the old sacrificial system. The first 10 chapters of Hebrews have so far discussed that Christ is superior to the angels, that Christ is greater than Moses, that Christ is superior to the Old Testament priesthood, that the New Covenant is superior to the Old Covenant. In the middle of chapter 10, there becomes kind of this shift. And instead of just explaining the superiority of Christ and the New Covenant, it becomes a call to persevere. And that begins in chapter 10, verse 19, where it says, now let's get down to saying, we've got to persevere. We've got to hold on. Chapter 11 is a title that people refer to it as the Hall of Faith. People often give it that, the message. And it talks about guys like Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and Joshua. It even discusses Rahab and Gideon and Samson and David. All of these people were faithful to God. All of these people kept their commitment to God. All of them were faced with opposition. All of them were examples of people that faced tremendous persecution and opposition, but who still stood true to what God had called them to do. Chapter 11, beginning in verse 35, the second half of that says that others were tortured. They refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. These people that we've mentioned were not perfect people. They weren't the perfect examples of faith. They did not live an easy life. They had their struggles. They had hardships. They had their past that they had to deal with. And some of them had a past filled with sin. They had to overcome that. You think of some of these guys that are mentioned here. Men like Noah, who was faithful to God, and God saved him by telling him to build the ark and to bring his family with him. And then what's one of the first things he does whenever he gets back out on dry ground? He passes out drunk. That's probably not the perfect image of faith that you want to present to your kids and say, be like Noah. Or Moses, who came to realize that he was from the Hebrew people. And as he saw the Egyptian slave driver pressing too hard against one of his fellow countrymen, he murders him. Moses had to overcome that murder. They had pasts that they had to overcome. They had done things that were sinful. We all know about David and his sin with Bathsheba. These were men and women who had pasts that they had to deal with. Rahab, the prostitute. And yet she's mentioned in here amongst all these men as an example of faith. You see, they had a past, but they also knew they had a future. They had a purpose. They had a reason to press on and to endure. And they continued on in that calling. And so we get to our text in Hebrews chapter 12. And we read, therefore, I used to have a teacher by the name of Ed Wharton that would say, I can't get his voice out of my mind. He'd say, when it says therefore, you ought to go back and find out what it's there for. So that's why I gave us a little bit of the background information of what has already taken place. And all of that stuff leading up to this, he says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and a sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, and you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those that he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Verse 7, endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us. We respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and your weak knees. Make level paths for your feet so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. That is a motivating chapter to me. I can't help but read that with a little bit of emotion. I can't help but read that and say I have to endure. It starts off and it talks about this great cloud of witnesses, and that cloud refers to all the people that were mentioned in chapter 11. The Moses and the Noah and the David and all of those other people that have been mentioned in there. The word surround carries with it, in the original Greek language, it carries this sense of competitors on a playing field, filling the crowd, towering above them. It's like Friday night and the home team is on the field and it's game time and the kickoff comes and you feel the energy. that word surround carries with it that kind of connotation. By such a great cloud, cloud in early literature has a connotation of unity, and witnesses witness and testify to the truth. These words together carry that sense of a group of people united in purpose, cheering on a competitor to stand for truth. This is that home field advantage. And isn't it great to have that as a Christian, as a child of God? The cloud of witnesses stand as examples of those who have crossed the finish line despite their own hardships, despite their own trials. And I love the metaphor of the marathon that it presents here, because a marathon shows stamina and endurance, and it shows training. All of these things are needed in our Christian walk. I've been to places where people have said that once they were baptized and became a Christian, they were left to try to walk on their own. No one would study with them after that. And I thought, what a shame that is, for that to happen. Because we wouldn't do that to our children. When our son Timothy was born, I didn't just put him in the middle of the floor and say, okay, walk. I had to carry him. We had to feed him. We had to clothe him. We had to take care of him. We had to show him so that he could be independent enough to do things on his own. He becomes more and more independent each passing week. And that's a lot like the Christian journey. It takes training. It takes somebody that's going to walk beside you and with you. And we have this cloud of witnesses about us that are cheering us on. And it's going to take some time in order for us to be able to cross that finish line. We're going to have some hardships running this marathon called the Christian life. A part of that marathon, we are told, is throwing off everything that hinders. Now, you can't tell it by looking at me now, but I used to run track. And when I would run track, I was a sprinter. And whenever you were running a race, there was no rule that said you couldn't hold your cup of Gatorade and run the race. There was no rule that said I couldn't wear my warm-up jacket and run the race. But if I had had that on and if I had been carrying that Gatorade, there's no way I would have won. I may have seen everybody way ahead of me and just said, oh, forget it, and sit down on the side of the track and drink my Gatorade. You see, you have some things that you gotta put off. Those things aren't bad, they have a purpose, but they hinder us sometimes. And it says, throw off the sin that so easily entangles. And I like how it words each of those different. It says everything that hinders. Well, sin is definitely a hindrance. But it goes farther and says that sin entangles you. When you're entangled, there's no way you're going to be able to run a race. If you tie a rope around my leg and I take off running and you pull the rope, I'm going to fall. And that's the image that it presents. It says there are things that hinder you, and then there's sin that just throws you down on the ground. That entangles you. That traps you. And it says to throw off both of those. Get rid of everything that hinders. Throw off the sin and keep running. Keep running this race. I mentioned that I did sprint, the 100 to 200 meter. One day my coach wanted to punish me, I guess, and he told me to run the 2 miles. You train for that a little bit different than you train to run 100 meters. And I didn't train that way. I trained for sprint. And so I took off running, and I was in first place, and I was lapping. I was halfway through the first lap, and there were people still on the first 100 meters. And I felt so good. And I was running this race, and I knew I was going to win because I was so far ahead. And I finished the lap, and I was in first place. And then all of a sudden, I realized I had another lap to go. And so I said, oh, I better slow down and pace myself. But I didn't know how to pace myself. I'd already exerted so much energy that first lap. And so I continue running this race. And then I get around, and it's the third lap, and the people have caught up to me. And then I say, okay, one more lap to go, 4 laps. And they say, no, that's 1 mile. You have 5 laps left to go. I continue running. By this time, I'm in last place, and all I want to do is quit. All I want to do is give up. That Gatorade sounded good to me. I wanted to go sit down and,
well, more like fall down,
and have somebody throw cold water on my head because I was burning up and it was hot
and I was running this race that I wasn't prepared for, that I hadn't been training for.
And the only thing that kept me going in that race was my teammates were running alongside of me
in the grass saying, come on, you can do it. You can do it. It was
the last race of the year, and that's why they put me on the 2 mile, because they known I would have never come back again after that. And they were running alongside, cheering me on, saying, you can do it. You can finish this race. You can get through this lap. You can get through the next lap. You can do it. And the whole time they were there, and they stood to me as a cloud of witnesses.
And when I finally crossed the line,
I was not in last place. I was in second to last, because the guy tripped.
But I finished the race, and I crossed the line,
and at that moment, I realized that something special just took place.
And if I didn't have that support system in place, if I didn't have with me that cloud of witnesses cheering me on,
the race would have turned out differently, and maybe I would have turned out differently. There's a couple of things to gain from that.
One I've already mentioned is the need for that support system.
And according to Hebrews, we have that. We have that cloud of witnesses cheering us on in this Christian marathon. And the other part of that is that it takes training to run a race. You don't just get out there and go. I don't just wake up and say, you know, I haven't ran since high school, but I'm going to go run the Boston Marathon. And buy my ticket and go there, and I wouldn't make it because I haven't been training. Our Christian walk is going to take some training. We have to spend time studying our training manual. We have to spend time learning from our coach. And while we can gain insight from those who have gone before us, nobody knows this race better than the one who wrote the manual. And yet, I struggle with throwing off everything that hinders. And it's a struggle sometimes to get rid of the sin that wants to entangle me. But the writer of Hebrews knows that that's the only way that we can finish this race. And he says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. If we're going to cross that finish line, we have to have a clear vision. We have to have a clear vision of Jesus.
We have to fix our eyes upon Him. We have to
run this race. I'm a sports fan, so all my analogies have to do with sports.
I've watched some interviews. Whenever we used to live in New York, we actually had a wonderful channel called the NFL Network. I'm kind of glad I don't have it anymore because it was a hindrance at times. But as I was watching some of the interviews with some of the great running backs, and they would ask them, what's the one thing you need to be a great running back? And they say, you have to have vision. You have to set your eyes on the goal and focus on that goal, but still be aware that there are traps and people waiting to hurt you, people waiting to catch you.
And I think that we can compare that to what he's saying in Hebrews. We have to fix our eyes on Jesus.
We have to look to Him. We have to have a clear vision of where we're going. That's the goal line. That's the finish line. And that's where we want to be. And whenever you're running the race, if you look behind you, you're liable to fall or go into the wrong lane
and be disqualified. But if you fix your eyes straight ahead, then you can complete the race. You can finish the race. And one thing I love about the Christian race is that it's not about coming in first place. It's about finishing. It's about completing something. It's about staying true to God, staying true to Christ. Another thing that is mentioned in here, you can't tell, Hebrews 12, the first three verses are some of my favorite verses in all the Bible. But it says, verse 2, "Let us fix our eyes upon Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sit down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, that you may not grow weary and lose heart." Did you catch something in there?
Did you catch that word joy? It seems so out of place when you're reading this.
Let us throw off our sin. Let us throw off everything that hinders.
Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, who for the joy set before him.
When Jesus walked the earth, what did he have to look forward to on this earth?
A cross.
Now,
if you're reading this, when I was in Texas going to school, people used to always talk about how in Texas you can get the death penalty for speeding.
I mean, you know, they seem to dish it out there more than any other state.
You're talking to somebody on death row and they're going to their execution. Is that a whole lot of joy that they're feeling?
Not under normal circumstances. But this says that Jesus,
who for the joy set before him, endured the cross.
There's something he's seeing beyond the cross that is giving him joy. It's not the cross in and of itself that gives him the joy. It's something beyond the cross that gives him the joy. And he endures the cross, scorning its shame, and he sits down at the right hand of the throne of God, cheering us on
towards salvation.
I believe
that this teaches us that the joy that Christ had was our salvation. The joy that he sees beyond the cross is the salvation of mankind. This is the opportunity for us to come to him and lay our burdens down,
to accept him in baptism and to spend eternity with him. That joy allows him to endure the cross. That to me is just a wonderful thought. To think that our salvation could be his joy. That our salvation
could help him endure the cross.
I'm a very visual learner.
I have to picture things. When I read a book, I have to picture what's going on.
And whenever I read this, I picture
Jesus carrying his cross. And it's getting heavy.
And the people are mocking and spitting and cursing.
And I don't know what's going through his mind. But perhaps there are moments when he wants to give up. We know that in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prayed, "If there's any way possible, take this cup from me. But not my will, but your will be done."
And the Bible also tells us that he could call down legions of angels to come to his rescue.
But maybe the thought happened across his mind,
saying it would be easier just to call those angels.
But I get this image of Jesus as he's going to the place of an execution. And he's saying, "You know what? I'm going to stay true to the Father's will. Because there are people
in May of 2007
in the state of Arkansas that can experience salvation
if I just endure this cross." That is amazing to me to think about.
To think about something that is so far reaching as that. To think that something that happened a couple thousand years ago still has significance today. To think that something that
happened so long ago can change my life today is amazing. What an amazing thought. We're going to go through times of trial. We're going to have times of discipline. The Hebrew writer says that God disciplines those that he loves. In those times of discipline, those are the times that I have to look most to Jesus. Those are the times where I have to put the glasses on, the Jesus bifocal, and focus my eyes on him. Because as you're going through your day-to-day life, sometimes it's easier to just take things for granted. It's easy just to take for granted our salvation and our privilege. And those times of discipline remind me of how in need I am of my Savior. How I am so in need of Jesus Christ. And they remind me to fix my eyes upon Him. To rid myself of all that hinders. To rid myself of all the sin in my life. And to seek the true joy that is found in Him. I ask you tonight, how is your eyesight? Now, I'm not talking about can you see the words on the songbook, how far away or how close you have to hold it. I'm asking, how is your spiritual eyesight? What are you looking to? Are you looking at the world around you and wondering what's going on with this world? Wondering where is Jesus in the midst of all this? We live in a time of terrorist threats. I live in a city that is rated the second most violent city in the country, Memphis, Tennessee. Last year there were over 130 murders in that city. And you have those days and you go, what am I doing here? And it's at those times that I have to fix my eyes on Jesus. When I was a senior in high school, I was just kind of wondering about what to do with my life. And I thought, I may possibly want to do ministry, but I don't know if... I wasn't fully convinced that I really believed everything that I would be teaching about God and about Jesus. And I was really having some personal battles there, some spiritual battles. And it was in April of 1995 that the Oklahoma City bombing took place. And I was living in Muskogee, Oklahoma at the time, but I had grown up in Oklahoma City area. And that rocked my world. My world was kind of shattered to think that something could happen that close to where I am. And it was at those times when people were questioning God and saying, where was He? There were books written with the titles, Where Was God at 9:02 a.m.? And it was during that time that I had no choice but to fix my eyes on Jesus. Because that was the only place that I could find refuge and comfort. That was the only place where life just seemed to make sense. The writer of Hebrews says, fix your eyes on Jesus. Fix your eyes on Jesus. So I ask you again, where are your eyes focused? Are they focused on the trials and on the hardships going on in life? Are they focused on the discipline that's taking place in your life right now? Or are they focused on Jesus? And my prayer is that all of our eyes are focused on Him. All of our eyes are focused on Jesus. My prayer is that our spiritual eyesight can become 20/20. We have an opportunity tonight to respond. An opportunity that is given every week. An opportunity that goes beyond just Sunday. An opportunity to truly fix our eyes upon Jesus. An opportunity to get our eyesight right with Him. And I don't know where you're at in life, and I don't know what struggles you go through, but I know the one to look to, and His name is Jesus Christ. And if you came in here tonight and you just had a heavy load that you don't know what to do with, and you come here and you say, what am I going to do with this? I'm going to say, give it to Jesus. Surrender your life to Him. Whenever we surrender our life to Him in baptism, we begin a wonderful journey. And it is a journey. It's a marathon. And sometimes we need some extra encouragement in that marathon. We need to see that cloud of witnesses about us. We need to fix our eyes upon Jesus. And so if you need to do that tonight, now's a wonderful opportunity.